Today, are we winning or losing the war on terror? My guest is Patrick Skinner. He's been on the program several times before. He's the director of special projects for the SUFON Group and a former CIA case officer. Patrick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You have a provocative piece today called Losing the Fight Against Terrorism. That doesn't sound very good.
Yeah, I try not to be negative, but if you, by every objective measure, if you compare, 13 years of incredible effort and expense and, sacrifice, no, I mean, I don't know what measure you could say that we are winning the war on terror compared to where it was 13 years ago.
Give me some perspective, numerical, statistical. How do you draw this conclusion?
So Al-Qaeda at the time of, the Al-Qaeda of bin Laden, right before 9/11, probably had about 400 people. Now, they were the worst terrorist group, and of course they did 9/11. So right after 9/11, they were dismantled, and we've kept them from conducting another 9/11 style attack. They always, they're interested in what's called a spectacular attack. And so by, I guess, that measure, we have not had a repeat. But what we've had, instead of 3,000 people killed in one attack, we've had thousands and thousands and tens of thousands more killed every year in terrorism since then. The numbers are through the roof. Last year, 18,000 people were killed worldwide in like 60,000 terrorist attacks. And so if Al-Qaeda was 400 people right after 9/11, and now their core leadership, of course, is under great pressure, but there are thousands of them, and they've franchised. Now we have them in Yemen, and we have them in Morocco and Algeria and Saudi Arabia. And so,
and Nigeria and Syria and Iraq.
And so the list is endless. And some of that is just because of the spread of social media, which and the ubiquitousness of communications, but a lot of it is the failure to address the root causes, but also the ideology. And so by any measure, I mean, we spent so much money and time trying to do this, and I don't know what measure you could pick that would say we've succeeded.
A handful. I mean, it's Al-Qaeda has been around since, a long time, but all these other groups, Islamic State, Boko Haram, are newfound. The Taliban, of course, is not. Talk about the differences between these groups now, the similarities and the differences.
Well, I think all of them start out, except for like maybe Al-Qaeda, as local grievances, but certainly Boko Haram. I mean, they're specifically up in northern Nigeria, which has almost no connection with the government. It's the poorest place, the poverty. Most of the people live under $5 a day. So that kind of poverty and disconnect with the government is pretty universal for a lot of the homegrown groups. Al-Qaeda has been around for so long, but the Taliban started the exact same way. The government, after there was a collapse in the civil war in Afghanistan in the 90s, and then the Taliban basically took control of this chaos. And the same thing's happened in Iraq. Same thing's happened in Syria. Chaos with a disconnect with weapons and extremism is a really bad combination. I think what unites them is more than what divides them. I mean, you can't say that each group has the same exact methodology or the same philosophy, but you can say that pretty roughly and pretty accurately, though, that they're bound together by bin Ladenism, which is basically the violent ideology of bin Laden. And so all of these groups espouse bin Ladenism, and it's amazing. So he's been, he was killed 4 years ago or so, and I guess three and a half years ago, and his message now is more widespread than when he was alive selling audio tapes.
My guest is Patrick Skinner, former CIA case officer, director of special projects at the SUFON Group, a security consulting firm. You say in your piece that other methods could have been tried. The need for alternate approaches. What should we, could we have done differently?
Well, I think at the beginning, it's a lot of the reaction when people say like, oh, well, you have to remember what it was like after 9/11. And I was around there. I was involved. And yes, so you had to understand and cut a lot of slack for, ad hoc solutions at the time. But, the week after 9/11 is not the same as a year after 9/11 or 2 years or now 13 years later. And so from a tactical standpoint, we are, especially the U.S., is incredible. Our counterterrorism or CT tactics are amazing. Drone strikes, if you look at it in isolation, are very effective. Targeted attacks and intelligence collection is really effective. But the problem is only if you look at it in isolation. So I think we missed some opportunities where, I mean, the war in Iraq was obviously just a disaster from every point of view. And without debating the merits of should we have gone in or should we have not, it's too late for that. But it's clear that everything fell off the rails after that. And the Middle East has never recovered. And our standing, we had some kind of goodwill, and we didn't really leverage that into change because we focused on the tactics because we were worried about another attack, which is, again, understandable. But a nation can't go crazy for, you know, for years. I mean, it's understandable for weeks or months. It's regrettable. But we've basically lost our mind, and we've never really kind of slowed down and say, okay, what is the strategy? Because these tactics have to lead to something. And so, as I wrote in the piece, every tactical victory actually makes it harder to win. We inflame local passions. We kill a leader, but then we kill a wedding party by mistake. And, you know, if you killed my family in a drone strike, it doesn't matter what kind of outreach program you're going to do. I will be your enemy. And we've created a lot of that.
I was talking to someone else who was in your branch of government, and you know, until, you know, relatively recently, who said torture doesn't work. And what I'm curious is, and I asked him this question, what do your former colleagues say about this question of torture that we're debating so openly right now?
Well, everybody I knew and associated with, one, had nothing to do with the program because it was so tightly held, but it was also contracted out. 99.99% of the actual agency officers had nothing to do with it. It was contracted out, which should give you a clue that if it's distasteful enough that you don't want your own officers involved, you probably shouldn't do it. I don't think there's a real debate among the line officers as to the efficacy of did it work or not. I don't think it's a double-loaded question. No, it didn't work. And two, even if it kind of did, you probably shouldn't have done it in the first place. I mean, if you need to take off your clothes, there are a lot of different ways to do it, and setting yourself on fire probably, you know, that'll work, but it's probably not the best way. And so I think that at least, you know, most of my former acquaintances would not, they didn't approve of it. A lot of people objected, and whatever tactical gains we got. So even assuming, I understand why the old leadership is defending it, because I mean, their names are tied to it, so I that's okay. It's way above my pay grade, and I understand why they're factually wrong. But also, even if we accept what they say is accurate, that it led to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or it led to this person, which, by the way, their own document and their own internal review show that didn't happen. But even if it did happen, it's still not worth the cost. I mean, it's 13 years later, and we're still traumatized by this. 13 years ago, you didn't see a lot of American hostages being held in orange jumpsuits, and now you do.
So if you were president and you had a functioning Congress where you could actually get things done, well, here's a fantasy of gargantuan proportions, what would you do about Boko Haram, Taliban, the Islamic State, Iraq, and so on?
I think the first thing to do was I would immediately understand that some things can't be fixed. You know, I mean, they have to be fixed at a much lower level than us. Big programs normally don't work, and we found that in Afghanistan, where we've tried and we spent $1 trillion to rebuild a country that wasn't there in the first place, and these big programs don't work because there's no existing culture or infrastructure to support it. I would probably stop giving weapons to people. That would be the first thing. I've done a lot of conflict resolution. I've been around a lot of those areas, and giving weapons into an area just makes it much worse. So I would probably do two things. I would immediately try to get ceasefires whenever you could, certainly stop providing weapons to people, and then I'd work with the local governments or the national governments and say, okay, Nigeria, this is the money we were going to spend on a military operation. We'll spend some of that, but also how do we actually build infrastructure? How do we clean the corruption that is just wrecking this area? I mean, think about how bad our politics are in America. I mean, we can't believe how dysfunctional we are. And yet, I mean, people in Nigeria, Iraq, Afghanistan, they would die to have our problems. And then, well, the problem is they are dying because they can't even get to these problems.
Yeah.
And so it's the problem is the answers are really obvious, but they're incredibly difficult because they're so deep-seated and that it takes a lot of work. You need to do slow programs and then constantly measure it. I think one of the things that we do badly is that we do metrics poorly.
Explain what do you mean by that?
Well, we haven't. One of the lines is that, you know, if you're not measuring success, you're not succeeding, which is true. You should be aware of the impact you're having. And what we do is we don't have a really good way to measure success. So we have no idea until the end when it's obvious we're failing. Perfect example, in the Iraq or the Afghanistan war or conflict, whatever you want to call it, we've shifted the metrics so much. You know, violence is up, so we stop measuring violence. So we, because otherwise the program's a failure. And so you get down to where when you hear the government start talking about we've increased cell phone coverage by 100%, or we've passed out this many textbooks, you know that that program is in trouble. You know that the overall strategy is failing, because the end result is if they're not talking about casualties and life saved, and I mean, then you know that they're searching for metrics that will show what they're doing. You know, roads paved. That is important. But if it's roads paved that are facilitating car bombings, then what is the point? I think that we need to develop counter-violent extremism programs that are actually effective. Now, that's really difficult to do because it involves community outreach, community work that the U.S. government is terrible at, and understandably so. It's not something we do.
And the political process makes that very hard to say, let's spend money, you know, on hearts and minds, on creating goodwill by doing things that are useful. That's very hard to get funded, but weapons is easy in comparison.
Well, yeah, and it's also, I mean, from the client's point of view, I say like the U.S. government is buying something from a vendor. They like to have something, and that's understandable. You know, I don't want the concept of an iPhone. I actually want to hold the iPhone. And so people that can sell tangible goods usually can, you know, get the contracts, and weapons are extremely tangible. You can say, if we give weapons to the right guys, then this conflict is over, when, of course, it's impossible, and the right guys always turn out to be the worst guys. And so selling a concept like, you know, peace or harmony is foolish because it's so broad, but it's also, even if you could, it's hard to justify spending money on something that's intangible. But the thing is to break down the contracts. We do these gigantic there was a really good study that showed a lot of the aid delivery or a lot of the projects were so wasteful because by design, these giant companies in Washington, these projects have to be so large to justify a profit margin. They have to be big. And therefore, you know, I mean, think of if the United States ran every DMV in America, it would be really, really bad. And so, yeah, but we think we can do that for other people. In America, the government is never the solution, but in our foreign policy, the U.S. government is always the solution. And it's that there's something fundamentally wrong with that.
Wow. Well, Patrick Skinner, again, you leave me full of cheer and happiness at this Christmas time of year. And thank you for your insight analysis, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.